Thank you very much for coming here. I'm Vincent Sabatier. I'm the director and senior fellow in charge of space initiatives. Today it's an aerospace event. Initially, we are working mostly the space issues, but we got contacted by FAA to know whether we would be willing to host such a conference to discuss the cooperation between the U.S. And China in the field of aviation. So we thought it would be a good idea to compare what was going on in this field, because apparently it's much more dynamic than in space. And as you know, the Olympic Games are starting in Beijing at the end of the week, so we thought the timing would be perfect. And we are very happy to see so many of you here with us today. As you know, the big question is the bilateral relationship with China. We have an expert here with Charles Freeman, who's the China chair here at CSIS. So he will tell us more about the bilateral relationship. But what's clear is that China is still seen as a threat and as an opportunity by the U.S. And while there is no doubt that both air power and space power are key to national security, as I said, a very dynamic dialogue, I understand, is taking place in aviation and aeronautics, and we are very excited to hear about that today. However, in space, there is still very, very little going on. One must notice, however, that in the language in the new NASA authorization bill is requiring NASA to engage discussion about astronaut safety with both human space flight nations. So that means, clearly, Russia and China. As safety is one of the mandate of the FAA, we are very, very curious to hear about that, I mean, at least on the aeronautic side. So we are very excited to hear more generally about what's going on in this bilateral relationship in the field of aviation. So we have here with us today Dorothy D. Raymond, Acting Assistant Administrator for International Aviation at FAA. Dee is bringing a lot of experience in her job. She worked more than 10 years in the industry, both with Martin Marietta, Honeywell, MCI WorldCom, and the Mitre Civil Avance Aviation Systems. She's an expert in air traffic management, which is key for our future here and globally. And she has worked more than 10 years with FAA as well, so we are very pleased to have her with us today. And I'm going to leave the floor to my friend Charles, who is the expert on China. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Charles Freeman. I guess my job is to quickly lay in 3 minutes or less the groundwork for describing what the status of U.S.-China relations and how perhaps it impacts the subject for today. So let me try to do that. Fasten your seatbelts. The bottom line with the administration and China is that U.S.-China relations are very, very good on a macro level. Certainly, there is no longer, to the extent there was in the last 10 years, there's no longer any serious debate over whether or not we should be engaging China or containing China. Or confronting China, engagement has won the day, and there's no question that there's no going back. The administration has largely adopted a position with respect to China that was first articulated by former Deputy Secretary of State Bob Zelik in 2005. That is, we're going to treat China and hold China to a standard of being a responsible stakeholder in the global community. And what that means essentially is that the United States is prepared to make some room on the global stage for China's rise and to, I use the word advisedly, accommodate that rise to some degree. There is a specific recognition in the administration that that China has legitimate international interests, although exactly what those interests are and how legitimate there is not expressly recognized. All that said, there is a lot of blind men examining the elephant with respect to China going on in the United States, and particularly across the administration, the different agencies there is a bit of a stovepiping compartmentalization, a bit of a fractured approach to the question of threat versus opportunity, and even in the context of the responsible stakeholder framework, that threat versus opportunity question looms large. If you look at nervousness within the administration about China's rise, it really looks at all three components of power, whether that's China's military power, China's economic power, and even China's normative or soft power and its influence in global affairs. There's nervousness in each. And that, I think, is not going to change regardless of who comes in January 2009. That dynamic will still pervade, although, I don't believe that the clock will turn back and that a confrontational approach will begin to win the day. There is also certainly great public anxiety about China's rise, and I certainly think as we head into the Olympics this week, that anxiety will begin to spike, not just because China will become front and center in people's living rooms, but Chinese athletes will begin to win their share of golds, and Americans will begin to question our status on the planet and whether or not we're being pushed aside, whether or not we are actually not just making room, but whether we are making way. And that I think, will begin to color some of the public debate about China for the next bit and will begin to inform the compartmentalization of across the different agencies and the approach to the threat versus opportunity dynamic. That said, Vincent spends his time looking at questions of cooperation between the United States and China on space issues, and to some that hear about this, that's somewhat audacious. A certain audacity of hope here that somehow we can have cooperation with China on space when. We have when space has been uniquely our preserve in many respects, and that there are issues of concern about dual use technologies and other military applications to cooperation with space that would hold us back from really being partners or even cooperators or even acknowledging China's legitimate rights or legitimate interests in space. But looking back 20 some odd years, it doesn't. There was a 25 years or so. There was a period when we were just as concerned about cooperation on aviation and with China, and the notion that we would be working with China in the field of aviation would be was to many somewhat terrifying. Now, of course, China is. One of our most, if not most significant, customers for aviation technologies and airplanes and aircraft, and so this dynamic can be overcome. I'm not saying it will or should be in the space area. I'm just suggesting that casting our eyes forward to 10, 15 years from now, the audacity with which Vincent's program and his hope carries forward may not be as audacious as we believe. With that, I'll turn it over to Dee and Dee Reimold and ask her to talk about cooperation in aerospace generally. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, Vincent, for that lovely introduction. I'm looking around the room, and I see a lot of familiar faces, so it's interesting because I was reflecting a little bit on the remarks I'm going to make, and I will tell you right at the front of that several of the people in this room will have had personal experience in some of the achievements that we've had. So I won't belabor it. I will also tell you, being the third speaker in a relatively small lineup, and thinking on Friday when I looked at my remarks that I had a great lead-in referencing the Olympics, and now that both speakers have alluded to the fact that the Olympics are beginning at the end of the week, and isn't this a very good time meeting? It also forces me to update my remarks. So about 2 hours ago, I have a staff meeting with our international directors every Monday morning. And obviously, for our office in Asia-Pacific, our new director is moving from Beijing down to Singapore. This week he's still in Beijing, and I had occasion to talk to him, and I said, so Chris, how's everything going? And he said, it's smoggy. I said, well, yeah, we're reading that. And he said, the cabbies are unhappy. They have to wear a uniform. But he said, the overwhelming thing is that he said, you cannot imagine the immense amount of pride that you encounter with the people on the street. And he said, it is really such an exciting time to be in Beijing. And I did point out that his timing is crummy because he did arrange his move down to Singapore this week. So with that, thank you for the opportunity to come in today and to have a chance to talk to you all about the work that the FAA has done with China, the work that the U.S. government has done with China, and the opportunities that we see that are still ahead of us. So for those of you that have been following the buildup of the Olympic Games, you know about the bird's nest, the stadium, and you know about the water cube, the pool. And as the Olympics get underway, most won't give a second thought about it. Certainly the people that are watching it on TV or reading in the papers don't think about the infrastructure that's required to make those kind of things happen. There's thousands and thousands and thousands of people that have been at work in China and continue working, I would say, even until the last possible minute, getting ready to make the event a success. And for that, you have to have the buildings complete. You need the roads to the buildings complete. You need the roads to the airports and to the train stations complete. So in terms of aviation preparation, this translates into work in areas such as airspace restructuring, operational enhancements, and capacity enhancements. And the Civil Aviation Administration of China, the CAAC, has been hard at work doing just that. We know that because the FAA has been working closely with the Chinese government for the last several years in an effort to improve the safety and capacity of the aviation system as a whole, but with particular emphasis for these upcoming Olympics. So the CAC told us about 2 years ago that they anticipated a 30% increase in air traffic into the Beijing airport during the Games, and that their controllers were going to be prepared to handle more than 1,500 operations per day. So we looked at that, and we thought, what could we do to help them meet that challenge? So I'm going to be describing over the next several minutes some of those activities, but let me tell you that this week, we're going to see all of that work in reality. We have several FAA employees that are working side by side with their CAAC counterparts to handle those operations. And it's about keeping the focus not on just on the operations, but most importantly, keeping those operations safe. So the FAA cooperation with China is a pretty expansive program. It's now in its third decade. We timed our, if you will, formal partnership with the Chinese to coincide with the beginning, loosely, of their rapid economic growth and their opening their borders to the world markets that you were describing earlier. In the mid-90s, we took the step of locating an FAA representative in Beijing, knowing that this would be a place that would have the world's attention in terms of economic growth and, you know, as you mentioned, Charles, the sharing a stage, a world stage, it's a lot more than economics. It's about politics, it's about influence, and it's about partnerships across the world. So when people ask me what the FAA does in China, I say that we work closely with the CAC to enhance the safety and efficiency of China's aviation system. And these efforts both play a vital role in supporting the significant level of trade and travel between our two nations. So with that, I'd ask you all to consider these three points. The China-U.S. market is growing at a double-digit rate. To meet this demand, China and the U.S. recently signed a new air services agreement that authorizes U.S. and Chinese air carriers to operate 46 flights per day, 23 each, by 2012. The FAA will be working with Chinese authorities to establish systems that safely manage this growth. Point two, China's aerospace market is projected to be the second largest aviation system in the world within a decade. The FAA has the opportunity to promote the latest U.S. technologies and procedures to their Chinese counterparts, at the same time assisting China with its modernization efforts. Point three, it is vital for the FAA to cooperate with China due to its emerging leadership position in international aviation to promote interoperability and harmonization. It's particularly important at this time as we transition to advanced aviation systems of the future, such as our next generation air transportation system. So when you consider these three points, I think you can understand how every major FAA technical and regulatory organization is involved in some form of a project or program associated with China's aviation growth. These include air traffic, flight standards, aircraft certification, airports, and of course, the Office of International Aviation. I'd like to begin by discussing our technical cooperation activities in each of these areas. For air traffic, to put some scope on it, the Chinese military currently controls approximately 80% of China's airspace. Now, I would like you all to also consider that China's airspace is roughly the same as our own. So it's a phenomenal amount of airspace. Drawing from our own experiences, the FAA has fostered a dialogue between the civil and military air traffic control authorities to encourage expanding capacity and increased safety of China's aerospace. We're encouraged by the fact that several temporary routes previously under military control have been established for civil use to ease congestion and to allow for those operations I mentioned just a few minutes ago. We certainly remain hopeful that this dialogue will remain ongoing and that there will be shifts to accommodate the civil aviation growth that's been forecast. So let's talk about capacity. The eastern portion of China's airspace is near saturation in terms of its capacity. This includes routes between the busy aviation hubs of Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangzhou. With China's emphasis on expanding access to Western China through increased aviation operations, capacity constraints along additional routes will become evident over time. Airspace is a finite resource, and China's growth will quickly exceed current capacity, even with the addition of new operational procedures and new technologies. Chinese airlines are forecast to purchase more than 2,600 commercial aircraft over the next 20 years. This forecast, however, is based on adequate capacity. So it is in our best interest to ensure that sufficient capacity and flexibility in the Chinese airspace system are available to safely introduce these new and increased operations. Similarly, more airspace will be necessary to accommodate the expected growth in the general aviation sector. Some experts have projected that the general aviation fleet in China could expand from just over 700 aircraft today to as many as 10,000 by the year 2020. Increasing numbers of helicopters will also increase the need for airspace. As you know, the important role of helicopters for search and rescue and emergency relief was highlighted during the earthquakes that occurred in this past May. While on the topic of air traffic, let me take a moment to describe in a bit more detail the work that we've done in preparation for the Olympics. The U.S.-China Joint Air Traffic Steering Group, or JATSIG, is a cooperative air traffic program that was successful in working with China to implement advanced procedures known as Reduced Vertical Separation Minima, or RVSM. After several years of work, China was successful in implementing RVSM procedures in November 2007. this was a singularly important step to increase China's airspace capacity by adding additional altitudes to the route structure. Now, I'd like to also underscore something else. While the RVSM was considered a highlight of the work that the JADC2 did last year, I would tell you that the JADC2 has been in operation for several years, and it is a set of priorities that's updated annually to reflect where the emphasis is on the air traffic needs. It's an important vehicle because it gives our technical experts an opportunity to interface directly with the CAAC technical experts to identify and set priorities. And it is a very, very useful group. We've provided technical guidance and training to assist the CAAC in developing the first visual flight rule charts in China so that emergency services, traffic monitoring, and news coverage can safely support the Olympics using helicopters and other small aircraft. It's an important point. I mean, for anyone in this room that has ever seen the amount of preparation that goes on domestically for big events, the Olympics in Salt Lake, Super Bowl, you know how much work that is. So we've had a lot of experience. It was easy to share with the Chinese. We've also focused for the last couple of years, as I mentioned earlier, on airspace management issues and airport master planning. We were fortunate that our rep in Beijing had an air traffic background and had experience for dealing with the high-volume operations such as Olympics, such as huge sporting events. So the work that Chris Metz did over the last several years in working with the authorities was singularly helpful. And lastly, I mentioned a few moments ago that we have a number of people in Beijing that are going to be working with their counterparts to help them manage and provide real-time consultations in the course of the Olympics and the operations. So the next area, I'd like to talk about our work with from the Flight Standards Organization. China's safety record has improved over the past years, and those efforts have resulted in one of the lowest accident rates in the world. In fact, there's been no reported aviation fatalities since November 2004 when the China Eastern flight crashed with 55 fatalities. That accident served as a catalyst to focus greater attention on training across China's aviation sector. So that training placed an emphasis on institutional stability and enhanced safety training for the aviation professionals. The FAA Flight Standards Service has established a group much like the JADC2 air traffic group I just mentioned. The Flight Standards Group has established a working group that meets annually to identify its priorities in terms of aviation safety areas. And there is a cooperative program that is literally a meeting either in China or in the U.S. to determine what the latest training opportunities are, what the latest technologies that our Flight Standards Service is using. So it's very much, what I'm trying to describe is very much of a hands-on training and safety focus. Aircraft certification is another key area that the FAA has been working with the CAAC. As a little bit of history, since the early 70s, China has been a supplier of aircraft parts and components to U.S. aircraft manufacturers. This relationship has grown, and China has become a supplier on programs like the Boeing Dreamliner, certainly a whole host of other Boeing products. And in view of that relationship and that the U.S. government set up a bilateral airworthiness agreement with China in 1991, that BAA was replaced in 2005 by a bilateral aviation safety agreement that former Administrator Blakey signed in October of 2005. and with the intent of advancing future aviation safety cooperation. So the bilateral agreement facilitates the import and export of aircraft and products, and this is all background to tell you that the Aircraft Certification Service uses the BASA, the Bilateral Aviation Safety Agreement, and subsequent agreements to offer a wide range of technical assistance and training to the CAAC. Also very important to note that the Aircraft Certification Service opened an office in Shanghai to work with the CAAC as they were building and setting up a framework to certify the operations of their RJ-21 regional jet. I was going to just make the comment off note, sorry, that the certification office in Shanghai has been open for about a year and a half, maybe almost 2 years, and it is obviously our second office in China, which should also underscore, without any further detail on my part, the importance that we place on the work with China. It is the single country around the world that we have more than one office for an FAA representative. In the airports realm, our Office of Airports has worked with China for several years on airport safety and development issues. We've conducted training programs in airport safety certification and inspection for airport inspectors. We've conducted seminars in Beijing on airport pavement design and maintenance, and also for the mitigation of wildlife hazards near airports. In addition, airports and air traffic organizations met just a few months ago in Beijing to discuss future cooperative efforts on runway safety issues, huge focus of interest across the world, but particularly so in China. And then one of the most emerging areas of cooperation, and I would characterize it as very very recent, is direct conversations on environmental issues. So we've talked with China on safe and efficient operations, and the clear message being that the more efficient an operation is, the less you're going to have, you know, impact to the environment. But we also approach it from the fact that it is such a contentious environment world, contentious issue worldwide. Many of you in this room are aware of the emissions trading scheme that's been proposed by the Europeans, and that the U.S. has remained very, very vocal to explain that we are not opposed to the idea of trading schemes, but we are opposed to the idea of unilaterally imposed schemes. And with this, we are in absolute partnership with the Chinese. China, as well as the U.S., have representatives on a special group that's been formed by the International Civil Aviation Organization in Montreal, the GIAC. China has certainly been a partner in helping us to further the notion that technologies and other forms of alternate fuels, operational procedure efficiencies, are a much better short-term focus that could be placed on other than fighting with each other about unilaterally imposed schemes. So we are hopeful, I think, that and our dialogues with the Chinese will continue on this score, that that we can get the rest of the world and, in fact, our partners in Europe to concur with this approach. The significant area of the environment that I would also like to touch upon is the initiative that the FAA introduced at the Singapore Air Show in February, Aspire. And the Aspire certainly draws on the technologies and procedures that are the framework of our next generation air transport system and the cooperation that that will be needed from the industry as well as governments to implementing these kind of systems. And we are hopeful that future conversations on Aspire or other future environmental initiatives will grow to include other partners. For the time being, I will caution you that Aspire is currently a partnership between government and industry in the U.S. and New Zealand and Australia. We're very, very confident that other partners in Asia will want to join, and I hope at a future session I'll be able to provide you all more information on that. So I've capped very quickly the work that the Air Traffic Organization, the Flight Standards Aircraft Certification, and airports have done. I would also like to, for a moment, just tell you a little bit about what my organization does. It's a policy-based organization, at least that's what it says on the various charters that I read about what API does. But I mentioned that we have an FAA senior representative in Beijing, and I've mentioned that we have a director in Asia Pacific. The office, one of its primary responsibilities certainly is to promote the FAA's activities worldwide. And as such, our work in China and the work that I mentioned that our previous rep had and his experiences in air traffic have certainly gone a long way to do exactly that. It's helpful when we're dealing with authorities that are very different from our own that we have someone on the ground that can explain how the FAA operates, how the FAA interacts with other government, how the FAA interacts with industry. And I would tell you that we have drawn on the success that we've had in China to help shape our priorities in other parts of the world. And this will become particularly evident when I talk to you about the next piece of work that we do in China, and that is the Aviation Cooperation Program. So the Aviation Cooperation Program, for those of you that have not heard the term, or ACP as we lovingly refer to it, it is a joint government and industry effort. It is made possible by funding from the U.S. Trade and Development Agency and contributions of U.S. industry. And I look around the room and I see a lot of our industry partners here today, and thank you for your continued support of the ACP. But its primary purpose is to advance the aviation partnership between the U.S. and, in this case, China. The rapid growth of the ACP, and by that I mean it grew from an initial membership of 10 companies in 2004 to 33 at current count, which I think is a huge indication of its success. The membership includes, among the industry, as well as industry people, the American Chamber of Commerce in Beijing. Obviously, I mentioned the TDA, the FAA, and the U.S. Department of Commerce. The funding allows us to identify technical assistance programs. And one of the ones that I think is most familiar to the people in this room that are familiar with the ACP is the Executive Management and Development Training Programs. So this EMDT has been in place, Gene, I think this is our third year going into it. And it is a most unique program. It takes mid-level managers from the CAAC and Chinese airlines and for over the course of several months exposes them to a variety of classroom and real-time situations, teaching them everything that we know about subject matter expertise in flight standards or air traffic or airports, but also management issues, organizational development attributes. It is a very, very comprehensive program. And we've already been able to see some signs of success. We've had some contact with some previous students and have been fortunate to find out that they have been promoted within the CAAC. And I think what that has told us is that it is a lesson that something that we in the U.S. do very, very well, we are able to teach other people to do, and that people have grown as a result of it. So we're terribly proud of the EMDT, but I don't want it to overshadow the rest of the ACP work. So the ACP programs are identified on an annual basis, and for this year, we are going to be talking about flow management issues, the continuing work on helping the Chinese authorities with their certification efforts for the RJ-21. We're focusing also on the general aviation and regional airline development. And, of course, the EMDT program will be another tenet of this year's ACP. So I think that I would tell you the reason that I made the comment earlier about our range, our the Office of International Aviation, and how importantly we view the ability to promote what it is that that the FAA does particularly well and how it is characterized in the ACP, that we've actually taken the ACP model over to other countries in the world. And much like the EMDT program, you know, I'm sorry, I'm a bureaucrat, so these acronyms are coming at me fast and furious, but the way the EMDT program has been a success and we've modeled it year after year, the ACP program, which is the large umbrella program, has been so successful in China that we have initiated an ACP in India, and we have hopes of initiating one in South America. I can't put a time frame on it, but it to me is just a remarkable model and a statement of success for the U.S. government and U.S. industry. So I'm not going to belabor, and I'll certainly have a chance to answer any specific questions about ACP, but I will tell you that when I talked about all of the separate activities that our lines of businesses conduct and the work of the ACP, this partnership between government and industry, I would tell you that we anticipate continuing cooperation with using these and other tools as China's aviation sector expands to meet its growing economy and associated international travel and trade. And the key to all of this, of course, is partnership. We'll continue to look for opportunities to work with China, and we'll continue to look for opportunities to work with other government agencies and with industries. Now, I realize that many of you may be thinking that these aviation activities are a bit far removed from the work that you do every day. However, if you're involved in any aspect of travel and trade with China, the aviation relationship between the United States and China should matter to you. And I encourage you to follow our continued efforts to strengthen this relationship and to contact my office at the FAA if you'd like any additional information on any of the work that we do. It was indeed a pleasure to be with you. It is indeed a pleasure to be here with you today and to have an opportunity to talk to you about this work. And let's move on to a more interactive portion so I can stop looking at the paper and maybe answer any questions that you all might have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dean. Let's open the floor for questions.
My name is David Logsdon. I'm from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. I'm also on the United States Position, Navigation, and Timing Advisory Board. And my question is in relation to global navigation satellite systems. With the projected growth in general and commercial aviation for flights in and out of China, and with the Chinese global navigation satellite system named COMPASS, supposedly going to be up and running within the next decade, have the United States and the Chinese started discussions on landing fees?
Well, I can't answer that question. What I would like to talk, if we could, I'm going to let you know in advance, I'd like to segue that question a little bit and certainly get back to you on the landing fees issue. So the topic of satellite navigation is certainly one near and dear to our heart. And certainly as we introduce new technologies, they are satellite-based technologies. When we go and talk to the our counterparts in China and talk to them about technologies like ADS-B, we are clearly talking with an inference to using a GPS-based system. And because the government of the U.S. government has offered to provide the GPS services to the worldwide community, we include China in those discussions. Now, I, of course, am aware that China is and has talked for a long time and is actively working on launching its own satellites. I think that is a whole other phase of issues and discussions. So for the time being, we certainly promote our own existing satellite technologies. And, you know, I think it would be incorrect to not acknowledge that China has also worked with the European community and the Galileo front and has made a significant contribution in that regard. So I think, you know, I would expect that they're keeping their options open. They would avail themselves to a number, you know, to a number of different systems with the idea that, you know, perhaps their own system. I'm not sure if it would be solitary or complementary. I simply don't know that.
Dick Oberman from the House Science and Technology Committee. Earlier in your remarks, you mentioned NextGen and that activity. What's your general assessment of the state of the Chinese air traffic control modernization activity, and how do you plan to interface with the Chinese on NextGen?
That is a question I can't answer, so thank you. So we're very optimistic. We have engaged in specific discussions related to cooperation with NextGen with the Chinese for over 2 years. In fact, it was a specific topic of discussion for both previous Administrator Blakey and for Acting Administrator Sturgill when he was the deputy, meeting with their counterparts to talk about ways that that cooperation could be formalized. We have, you know, ongoing working groups that go over and talk with their CAAC counterparts. And what they're doing, the talk about the cooperation is, I would confess, a fairly broad area. The working groups talk about specific technologies. I mentioned ADS-B a few minutes ago, the RNP, RNAV. Those things are talked about in great detail. We are very optimistic that there will be cooperation in those areas. That said, I think it is also safe to say that that the focus for the last many months has been on the Olympic preparation and less about, so I would characterize that as more tactical, and then certainly the NextGen discussions as more strategic. I'm hopeful that certainly any other FAA executive that has the opportunity to go over to China, including our Chief Operating Officer, Hank Rakowski, will be continuing the dialogues that that Marion Blakey and Bobby Sturgill have initiated.
I'm Ed Soyster. A question is sort of a cultural question.
Microphone, please.
Yeah. I'm Ed Soyster. A sort of a cultural question. Obviously, and you mentioned the success of the educational programs that we're doing, and of course we've done that many places around the world, and the old adage of you can take a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, and obviously, and our ability to teach, you mentioned, and obviously it's their ability to drink. Could you comment about the relation in terms of the different cultures, language, and so forth as you've put together this great cooperative effort? And how that's working, or where we could do better, what we need to make it successful?
Oh, well, thank you. I think that's a great question. When I was talking about the Aviation Cooperation Program, this umbrella program, and the Executive Management Development Training Program underneath the ACP, the MDT, I mentioned that, in my view, success has begot success. And I take your point. So we view something as very successful, and we recreate it or refine it or improve it year after year. I think it's it is a measure of success in my mind that the CAC and industry has continued to send students year after year, and in fact increase the number of students. So they clearly must view it as a success, and I think, you know, indeed they are drinking, to use your word, because we do see them, as we see people being promoted, these mid-level managers being promoted is one thing. But I would tell you also that part of the training program goes to some very specific areas, very specific disciplines. I mentioned the air traffic or the flight standards or our work with our industry partners that show them how airspace modeling can be done. We see that. We see them adopting practices, adopting ways of operations, and to me, it is reflective of what they are learning. I think it would be unfair to certainly characterize any of our training program as not learning something. So I think that this truly has been reciprocal, because it took us, I think, you know, the first course to understand what the areas of focus should have been. I mean, the first year was very broad, and with the subsequent years, we've narrowed the focus. And the fact of the matter is that our two sides, the FAA and the CAC, by virtue of the many conversations that they have and the exchanges, the CAC can better articulate to us what their focus is. So I think all of these things indicate clearly that they are drinking, and that this is really cooperative. It is, I can't underscore that enough. I have never seen anything but a shared cooperation and a shared interest in learning and teaching, and arguably from one another.
How about language?
It's been interesting, you know. let me make a general comment. As I travel around the world, I'm struck by the English language that people speak around the world, and wish that my daughter had been taught another language much earlier in her life. But the language is, with some individuals, probably more of an issue, but generally the students in the EMDT or even our counterparts in the CAC, language skills in English are very good. I think there's and I hope I'm not speculating, but your question may go more to the operational people, or is it just the students? So for the students, I'd say that, you know, we generally have students that have a very, very good command of English. Certainly the people that I've dealt with at the CAC, or our staff deals with at CAC, has a very good command of English. I think it's a requirement. On the operation side, I mean, I'm certain that if I were to ask the people and the working groups of the different people that are meeting with their counterparts in the CAC, they'd have the same response.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Parameswaran from Agence France-Presse, the French news agency. If I heard you correctly, you said that the Chinese military controls 80% of the airspace.
That's correct.
And if that is so, is it an obstacle to cooperation? And is there a mandatory requirement for the military to basically wean away or reduce this percentage for greater cooperation?
If there is a requirement, I'm not aware of it. Early in my remarks, I noted that we have engaged in dialogues that are designed simply to show them how we work with our military. I mean, it's China, like many other countries around the world, has airspace controlled by the military, and the science to us is letting them know how whether it's temporary or long term, you know, changes to that airspace management can be made. So that's mostly what we concern ourselves with. Now on the Chinese side, the airspace usage topic has been one of the primary topics that we've talked to them about since I can remember. So it is an area that I think there's genuine interest in learning how to manage more effectively. And we're hopeful, too. There's been, as you're probably well aware, there's been some changes in the structure of the government in China, and it has, you know, there's been a very definite change in how the aviation, the civil aviation superstructure is being handled. I don't know long-term whether that will have an effect on the airspace management issues, because certainly the military still has a very prominent place. But, you know, we remain hopeful that the dialogues, you know, the dialogue continues, and that both civil and military understand that there is a great deal of flexibility that can be introduced.
What do you see as the main issues that the next administration is going to have to wrestle with in terms of the U.S.-China civil aviation relationship?
Well, I think that one of the primary issues that will carry over is it's just simply managing that growth. So the growth is just so massive. It's on a scale that's, you know, it's on a scale that's similar, actually, to, you know, other countries in the world. But, you know, again, we've been in China for a while with this understanding and these forecasts of this growth. So I think the next administration is certainly going to understand that ongoing dialogues between our governments and the trade agreements will continue. The fact is, for the FAA, we very much plan to and have, you know, stated so in our flight plan, that we'll continue our focus on working with them. You know, we've seen the growth in the large airports. I think we'll expect to see, you know, continued growth in the certainly the medium-sized airports. I mentioned that we anticipate, you know, the growth in the general aviation and regional sectors. So that's going to have a corollary impact on the smaller airports. I can't underscore enough how much time we spend on trying to identify what the priorities are going to be in other parts of China other than the East. So the Western China development, which is very active, and opening up transportation options for the people over there, you know, is going to consume the FAA, and because it's going to consume the FAA, it's certainly going to consume the U.S. government. So that's on the infrastructure piece. I think the conversation we just had about airspace management will certainly continue. But, you know, I think just to summarize, I think the economic drivers that will force us to continue to spend the type of time and resources that we're spending on behalf of the U.S. government will continue.
Arno?
Could you tell us what the... Arno de Borgraaf, CSIS. Could you tell us what the status is of general aviation between the two countries?
The
private planes.
The status of general aviation?
Have you been negotiating on general aviation?
We have this year in the ACP program, I think, the general aviation is a focus for us under the ACP this year. So I think I'd be able to answer that question a little bit better probably about 8 months from now. We've had conversations about general aviation growth, simply recognizing that the desire to open up air transport and air transportation options in other parts of China will entail the use of general aviation. But there's a lot of work to be done. It is, you know, the airspace management issues, the airport issues I just mentioned. I think we'll have more fidelity in our thoughts and a better idea, a better program plan once we spend the time that we're going to be spending on it. So please save that question for me till the next time I get back here.
Yes, thank you, and forgive the drama here. The conversation began with the introduction of the concept of threat and opportunity, Personally, I'm Paul Chamberlain. I'm an adjunct fellow here and a consultant. And of course, we're familiar with the concept of hug your friends and hug your enemies closer. Well, my question to you, and thank you for your presentation this morning, is when you think about China and what we're doing, and you hear that comment about threat and opportunity, what kind of goes through your mind? More opportunity, less threat, manage threat with opportunity? What's going on inside?
The fact is, I personally view it very much as opportunity. I think the when I look around and I see the opportunities that are created for us as a regulator, as the regulator of the world's largest and safest aviation system, and to be able to share that, that's pretty heady stuff. I look at the opportunities that are created for the industries. And, you know, that said, I've had many, many conversations on the threats. And the threats range from a variety of sources. You know, the things that we read about in the newspapers. The cybersecurity issues, or the security issues you read about now on the with preparations for the Olympics. I think that I cannot think of a conversation that I've had within, you know, any kind of professional setting or U.S. government setting where the threat conversation has dominated the opportunity. And I don't think it is being ignorant or being unaware or unwilling to acknowledge it. I just think that overwhelmingly we see the development, and we see the fact that as China emerges and becomes such a force in the world, there's an attendant hope that we have that, you know, China becomes a greater force in the region itself. I mean, it's like any other large region of the world. There are some very, very fast-growing and very role model-like countries, and we're hopeful that, you know, China will continue to take on more of a role to help the more developing areas, if you will, in the region. So I think that, you know, we have a set of opportunities that we look at from a U.S. perspective. I think there's a set of opportunities being developed in China that could potentially be promoted to a greater degree in the region. So, you know, I think I keep coming back to the same thing. It's opportunity.
You mentioned something about the FAA will continue to look for the partnership, and also the government, as a government agency, also the industries in China. What I just curious is that all of the new partnership will be under the umbrella of the CAC, or you can go directly to the new partnership without the CAC.
Well, I think we do it today a couple different ways. So the as a government regulator, the FAA will continue to work directly with the CAAC. The FAA also has the opportunity under the Aviation Cooperation Program to work with other entities in China. So I think it will continue to work that, you know, work both of those avenues.
Even the new airport in the western part, western China. New airport, the
right.
Potential new airport in western China. You can go directly to talk to the authority there.
No, we'll continue to work through the CAC on that. I mean, we've worked with the CAC on a number of airport projects. And it is in a technical assistance and a consultation role. But, again, we do work through the CAC on that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Krishna from the South Asia program at CSIS. Sorry if I'm backtracking here, but I wanted to go back to the success of the ACP and how it's led you to recreate it in other countries like India. How successful would you say you've been in engaging India? And I guess the follow-up to that question is, how would you compare the relationship that the FAA has with China to the relationship and cooperation it has with India? Thank you.
Well, that's an easy question, right? Well, that's a great question, actually. The ACP with India is, of course, newer than the ACP with China. So I mentioned that the ACP with China was established in 2004. The ACP with India was announced by Secretary Mineta, I believe, in 2006, and then formalized when former Administrator Blakey went over in late 2007. So it's, you know, a couple of years later. We have a growing interest from industry for very obvious reasons. So I'm very confident that we're going to enjoy the kind of success with the ACP in India that we see in China. I would also say that the fact is we had an office in Beijing and a relationship with the government of China or with the CAC for a much longer period of time. Our office in Delhi is relatively new as well. So when I put all that together, while I remain very optimistic that we'll enjoy the same kind of success, I do think that we have to be realistic and know that we're a couple of years behind on both counts, both the relationship of our offices and the newness of the ACP. As far as the relationship, I would absolutely characterize the relationship that the FAA has established with the various aviation entities in India as moving forward. We've, by the way, taken the same model. I mentioned the Joint Air Traffic Steering Group, the JATSIG model. We've created a similar model in India. Again, the places are not exactly alike. We don't just cookie-cutter things over, but we take the best of what's worked in these different tools and use them in different applications. So overwhelmingly, I'd say we're on a very very much of a growing forward trend in India. Thank you.
Good morning. First of all, thanks a lot for your remarks this morning. My name is Bruce Scott, and I'm president of ITT Defense International. As I think you're aware, John Cafalotis sends his regards to you. ITT won the competition for the upgrade of the U.S. air traffic control system from radar to ADS-B GPS-based. I have two questions, one pertaining directly to China. I'm concerned we get inquiries all the time. As you would imagine, and as you know, we're just in the infancy of the prototyping for the U.S. ATC system. We want to make certain we're tied in properly with government, FAA, and other agencies to ensure that as we go down this path, that we are properly positioned to respond to China as they want, assuming they want to use the access that you've mentioned to our GPS satellites. So that's my first question. Are you comfortable with that arrangement? And second, there isn't a week that goes by where I don't get an inquiry from nations around the world on what we can do to upgrade their air traffic control from radar to GPS-based. And knowing the key role the government must play in this, as well as a prioritization of this, I'd just like to be reassured that the FAA and other government agencies are willing to work with industry to make certain that we proceed properly and that we have an opportunity to compete in regions around the world. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. That's absolutely a wonderful point. I'm glad that you brought it up. So the topic of ADS-B worldwide is one that dominates our conversations in China and other places. And there's a couple of different ways we look at it. So ADS-B, of course, is a very key piece of our next-gen strategies. And when I talked earlier about the cooperation that we hope to establish with China on the next-gen front, you know, ADS-B would be prominent with that. But that is, you know, obviously a more strategic interest. And the shorter-term answer is the FAA absolutely wants to be able to promote the best technologies and practices that we use. And to that end, you know, we are developing ways that we can help promote things like ADSB, using our representatives overseas, working with the program offices in Washington to make sure that the international component is identified in the international priorities. We also have a stakeholders group that we meet with quarterly. The WE FAA invites stakeholders in, industry stakeholders, and I know that John will be invited to those things, but that's another area that we plan to use the industry to help us think through how we can best promote U.S. Practices and technologies. I hope that I answered your
question. And just the general, over the transom request that we get in at ITT on from various countries on how we should proceed. We don't want to get ahead of the government on this, but at the same time, I know you have a priority, and we just need some guidance in that general area.
And that's a very fair question, because we struggled with it. You know, the problem is that a lot of times we'll encounter countries that believe they are ready for specific technologies and procedural enhancements that, you know, arguably they may not be. So, I mean, that it's a difficult balance. The best thing that we could do is just, you know, keep talking with one another. We certainly, we're a regulator. We don't get in the way. We don't promote industry. But what we can do is work with governments to let them know the technologies that we use and that we, you know, are using in our systems today. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm Ken Allen from CNA. And I'd like to ask you sort of tie a few things together here. I was stationed at the embassy in the late 80s and had a chance to escort an FAA delegation around in 89. And I haven't followed it that closely, but some things since then is CAC was just, it ran everything. And then they divided, had the regional airlines, came an FAA organization. My understanding is that sort of each of the regional airlines wanted to do its own thing. They bought their own ATC, they bought their own ILS. They sort of really didn't want management from the top. At that time, the PLA Air Force didn't even have a liaison office in CAC. And they, at that time, they were in control. 95% of the airspace, at least, are giving up some control. I think you paint a pretty optimistic picture of down the road. I'm not as optimistic when I think of a lot of stovepipe stuff in China. If you looked, you talked about 2020 having 10,000 aircraft, already lack of capacity. If you stand back, can you just sort of talk about how you think that the different entities in China, the regional airlines, with CAC at the top, with the military, how do they interact on a daily basis? And stand back, how are they going to manage this capacity and deal with all these regional airlines buying their own systems from a long-term perspective? Thank you.
Okay. Well, you're right. I do paint a pretty optimistic picture, because I'll tell you, just even within the last several years, we have seen phenomenal changes that lead to that optimism. With the understanding that the recent changes in the organizational structure to create this, if you will, Department of Transportation, it begins to take on a model that's much more identifiable, one that we can certainly relate to. I think that is certainly encouraging. I think that under the stewardship of the previous Minister of Transportation, a lot of the stovepiped arrangements in the CAC were changed. I mean, I think that's a simple fact. I think that Minister Yang had recognized that the way to move the organization forward was to take on structures that were more functional, not, you know, dedicated, if you will, to a specific airline's interest. So I think he started making changes in the mid 2000s that are, you know, still endure today. The fact of the matter is that for the first time, you know, I've been working these kind of programs specifically for like about the past 5 years. So about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, I went over to a conference in Beijing, and there were as many military people there as there were civil, which was tremendous to me, because prior to that, if you wanted to talk to the civilians, you went over for one meeting, and if you talked to the military, you went to talk to the military, it was another. So I think there is a genuine movement toward greater cooperation. I think that there is a lot, obviously the state airlines, have a huge say, but the fact of the matter is that we see some of the leadership changes and that are being made, and certainly taking from the most senior levels of these state aviation agencies to populate different parts of the CAC and the different ministries. I think that's a practice that will continue, because that's their source. But we're also looking at the fact that they take some of the graduates from the EMDT programs, and they're starting them up. Those are not people coming from state airlines. So I think that, we're watching a changing dynamic, a changing culture. And, I certainly hope that it is not misplaced optimism. But the fact is, it took, like anything else, it took a long time for the CAC to become the structure that it was. And I think it is truly in a period of evolution now.
Yuan Ye, the Voice of America. The first question is really just a technical one. Since you mentioned the Chinese military controls at the moment about 80% of the airspace in China, it just makes one wonder what's the percentage breakdown in the United States. Or maybe the U.S. works on completely different system.
Well,
I'm just wondering if you can...
Yeah, it does. It's actually almost the direct opposite, if I have my numbers right.
Okay, so please go into that after I finish my second question, which is pertains to the concept of the dual-use technology that Dr. Freeman alluded to in his remarks. I'm just wondering if the dual-use technology is ever a concern in the cooperation with the CAAC, be it at the training or the operational level. I mean, what measures do you take or what guidelines do you follow to prevent the information and technology that are transferred from the U.S. to China from being used for purposes other than they're intended to? Thank you.
All right. Well, let me. The first question on the airspace issue. So the U.S. Clearly has the bulk of its airspace is dedicated to civil aviation use. But, the more important point that I would like to leave you with is the fact that the U.S. military and U.S. civil authorities collaborate actively and openly all the time. So it is, we truly have a very, very flexible airspace. And again, those are the types of things that we enter into the dialogues with the Chinese about. To your other question, the earlier question on the threat and the opportunities, because, I think that you can't help have these conversations without that going through your mind. So let me try to put this into scale. We have the FAA hosts almost, 1,800 students every year from around the world. And I wish I had come equipped with the statistics. We have a lot of Chinese visitors of that number, on that average number. I wouldn't say it's the bulk, but we have a lot. And clearly, when we're managing any of our visitors, we have a way that we manage the visits and, what types of things that we talk about, what types of things, are accessible and what are not. And it's, we don't treat our Chinese visitors any differently than we do other visitors. We don't go into talking about the type of work that we do, the type of technologies that we use, the type of practices, with the idea that we are trying to hide anything. I mean, certainly our intent is to showcase the best of our practices and our technologies. We're mindful, of course, about access, and we simply are prudent in use of computers or anything else. So I don't know if I've answered your question. I hope that it is, enough to have you understand that we do approach our work with an open view and yet not unintelligent. Anyone else?
Maybe a last question, yeah.
It's Thomas Kushengaki with Futron. You talked about the safety record that they have, which is phenomenal. To what do you attribute that, given all of these disparate entities participating in this?
Well, I think that the single biggest thing is the focus that they've put on it. I mean, CAC, from our earliest conversations, was very clearly focused on safety. And, so that was one thing. Number two is that they availed themselves early on. So some of our earliest conversations with the Flight Standards Group was on aviation safety. So, I would attribute it to focus. I would attribute it to the fact that, they have bought a phenomenal number of new planes. They're not dealing with old aircraft. As they're developing, creating their new airports. I mean, these are the newest technologies. So I think it is, it's a confluence of things. But it's an impressive record. The one area I didn't mention in my remarks that I think bears some comment is that our commercial aviation safety team, CAST, for anyone that hasn't heard it, has worked with the Chinese authorities to have them implement safety improvements. And those are very specific, very targeted safety enhancements. And again, this is a nod toward the Chinese availing themselves to that kind of cooperation. If that's it, thank you all very, very much for your time and attention.
Thank you. I think that the conclusions will be very, very fast. Maybe if I can add some words. The first one is that opportunity apparently is seen as bigger than the threat in the field of aviation, which is quite a surprise to me, but which is very telling about the progress of the cooperation, which has started like 25 years ago or 40 years ago. So there is a great relationship, bilateral relationship. So that's very, very important to realize that, I think. And I don't know if many of us knew that before, but it's a very strong statement. I think behind these opportunities, there are three identified driving forces, as we discussed today. I think the first one is a need for China to modernize its aviation in order to grow and to keep on developing the West, but as well as the Eastern Territories. They need a stronger aviation. They need to get rid of this air traffic management problem they have right now and the saturation of the airspace. So that's I think, probably the biggest driving force is that China needs to progress on that in order to sustain its development. Then there is a bilateral, I would say, commerce environment where China is clearly seen as an opportunity. Globally, as you said, the trade between the two countries is growing at a double-digit rate a year, so that's a very, very important bilateral relationship. And within this commerce environment, there is, of course, the aviation side of it, where on one side, the U.S. manufacturers rely more and more on the Chinese equipment providers. And on the other side, there is this tremendous market with up to 2,600 additional planes to be bought by China by 2020, if I remember well. So that's a huge opportunity as well. And finally, there is a strategic opportunity, as you called it, and there we can find the three blocks fighting one another, you know. So you have clearly the satellite navigation system with GPS, while the US is promoting the use of GPS, while the Europeans are trying to involve the Chinese on Galileo. But the Chinese still have their own option open, COMPASS, so I don't know what this will give at the end. But that's very interesting to see this game at three. I don't know what role Russia is playing into that, but they have a navigation system as well. I don't think they are leaders, but and the second strategic item for me is the environment, the question about environment and aviation, where there is still some doubt about the effect, the forcing factor of aviation, and the CO2 emissions in high altitude, and where Europe, again, as usual, is favorable to regulate early, and the U.S., in this case, is teaming with China to maintain a stronger growth. So I think there was three different driving forces which make it for a very, very positive and strong relationship. I was very impressed by the number of areas in which you are cooperating, and I think it's a very good signal. We'll see whether or not this is applicable to space later on, maybe in 15 years, as you said, maybe earlier. We'll see, but anyway, it was very impressive. Thank you very much for your presentation, and we hope to see you again, probably after the Olympic Games.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.